You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
This is a podcast from ComediansComedian.com.
This is the Comedians Comedian Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith. This is the brilliant Jimmy Pardo, who, if you're not familiar with him in the UK, well done for downloading this anyway. Lots of people in the States will know him. Jimmy is someone who has built an enormous online following over the last few years. He got right in at ground level when it came to podcasting and has built up a huge audience, and who, in a very funny way, as you'll hear in this episode, reckons that this show will garner an enormous... He says this will get one of the biggest lots of downloads of any of my shows. It's very difficult to tell, you know, the play count and stuff. What does it actually mean? Who's listening more than once? All that kind of thing. But I'm looking forward to Jimmy being proved right by seeing a huge spike. He predicted a huge spike in downloads for this show because he's got such a massive online following, and they download and get stuck into everything that he produces. So if you're listening for the first time, if you're in the USA, thank you very much for downloading this one. If you're one of Jimmy's global internet fans and you're not familiar with this show, I am convinced that you're going to get a lot out of this. I'm really, really thrilled with this episode. For the rest of you who are already on board, it's absolutely quintessential ComCom. This, I think you're going to enjoy it enormously. This is Jimmy Pardo.
You are someone who I know from your comedy and from your podcast is you are a relentless riffing person.
But I don't. But I also can have a conversation. I can have a serious conversation. But I also like to.
I can see in your eyes that you're thinking of doing a line there.
No, I'm not. I'm actually not. I was actually going to sound like. You know, I use the expression about people that I think are truly funny called funny in the bones. I didn't make up that expression. One I like to use. Where there are people, Richard Lewis, Don Rickles, Johnny Carson, these people, they're funny in the bones. They can't help not be funny. And I fear that I am that same way. Todd Glass, a friend of mine.
Yes.
Funny in the bones.
Absolutely.
Whereas there's people that are comedians, and you know them, who they're dullards, but they're great comedians. They know how to write a joke. They know how to work the craft. But if you hung out with them, what a snooze. I'm kind of the opposite, where I don't understand the craft at all. I'm just naturally funny. And so that's what's going to happen here today.
Do you think that's true? Do you think that's are you being glib, or do you think that's a fair starting point for this conversation?
For me?
Do you genuinely feel like I've got no technique, I'm just funny?
I think some could argue that, but then some could argue that I'm not being fair to myself, because I can craft a story wonderfully. I know where the punchline could go. I know that if I'm telling a 9-minute story, which I have done many times in my career, where, you know, there was a time for most of the early 2000s where I talked about cutting my own hair, and it was about a 9 to 11 minute story, but there were punchlines every 45 seconds to a minute. I mean, there was still, like, you know, the equivalent of setup punch, but in a story format, you know, again, not reinventing comedy, but people would go, but it's 9 minutes about a haircut. It's like, yeah, but listen to the jokes along the way. Those all could kind of stand on their own.
Yes.
So I know how to do that. At the same time, or more recently, I'm doing a 9-minute story about going to the movies with the other comic, and then there's again, tangents and jokes along the way to getting to that final punchline.
I feel like I've heard that. I have heard that going to the movies.
That might be on my comic.
Yes, it is. Yes. Okay.
CD.
Gotcha. Yeah.
And it's 9 minutes long, and it's and the payoff. But there's a lot of payoffs along the way.
Yes.
To long-windedly answer your question, I cannot sit down and write a joke. I can't. I cannot do it.
And there seems to be a certain amount. I mean, you're being very emphatic and pressing the table there in a way that suggests you would like to be able to.
I would love to. I would love to. And I've tried many in the 20 plus years I've been doing this nonsense. I like when I moved to LA in 95, I said, you know what? Here's my day. I'm going to wake up. I'm going to have breakfast. I'm going to go to the pool and relax in the sun, read the newspaper, and then write for a couple of hours, then do my day. And that lasted exactly one day. As I sat down to then write after doing the pool and the newspaper, it's like it just seemed forced. I wasn't ever finding the funny. But if I went on stage and riffed about what I read, I could find the funny. But sitting down to write it, but I've got to, I envy the guys. I envy the comics that'll say, I'm going to go to the coffee shop for a few hours, and they come back with maybe two or three new jokes. Maybe 10, but three are decent.
Yeah.
I can't do it.
Why do you envy them? Do you think, do you think they maybe envy comics like you?
Oh, I think they do.
Yeah.
Because they always come up to me and go, oh, God, I wish I could riff like that. I wish I could work the crowd the way you do. I wish I could improvise an hour like you do, which is what I try to do. And it's like, yes, but I do that. Mainly because that is my skill. I'm not gonna dismiss that I'm good at it.
Mm-hmm.
But I wish to God that if I could sit down and write something and go to an open mic and try out new material. And
what would it? I think that's absolutely fascinating. And you, for comics in the UK or anyone listening to this in the UK or who isn't familiar with you, you are, I mean, undeniably incredible at crowd work.
Thank you.
You're an incredible improviser. I saw your podcast yesterday. Yesterday afternoon. And I tried to write down some of the incredible kind of machine gun speed of, like, you did a bit, but it wasn't a bit. I don't think it was a bit, but you were talking about your John Wayne, like your dad was into John Wayne, but then your dad had no eyes. That's because I stabbed them out when I was on meth. You know, and it was like this incredible trick of like punch, 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 punch,
right.
Punch. And I remember thinking, is this a bit? This can't be a bit. No.
And it'll never show up again.
Of course. It just tumbles out of you and it's funny, 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 funny. So with that in mind.
Thank you first.
What do you, well, you're very welcome. What, with that in mind, what do you think is driving your desire to be able to write a proper joke? What would it mean to you if you could do that? Why is it that you want to do that?
You know,
given that you can just walk on and be funny anyway.
You know, oh boy, that's a great, it's, well, I hate that I don't have the skill. And sometimes, quite frankly, I feel the skill to write a joke. I hate it. It drives me crazy. I also sometimes feel like I'm lazy. Like if I go to if somebody says, you want to do my show at the Virgil tonight? Or, hey, Monday, I just had a fallout. You want to come tonight? I wish I had new jokes that I had been working on that I could try out. Instead, I go there and I know I can do this. I know I can get on stage and be funny for 7 minutes. And I don't get that much out of it. You know what I mean? I get a lot out of it when I go on the road and I do an hour and I'm able to, you know, bob and weave and have some fun and find the funny. But if I'm doing a 7 or 10 minute set, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I should give myself a break here, Stuart. I don't know. I sometimes feel that I get off easy on being able to just go up and riff, whereas I wish that I had a purpose sometimes.
You get off easy, like you mean in the sense that you're not, it doesn't challenge you to do that. It
doesn't challenge me to do that. That's the perfect way to put it. Thank you. It doesn't challenge me because I know I can do it. And by the way, it's not always a home run. It could be a double. And then I feel bad about myself because it's like,
what do you mean by a double?
Sorry,
this is baseball terminology.
Baseball terms.
Okay,
I'm
got the
sorry.
Home run, the double I haven't heard of.
Double
is
when you get the second base.
Okay, yeah.
Again, America passed. I apologize. I forgot we beat you guys an award. You don't know all of our things. quit trying to be funny. Now, listen. When it's a – knowing that I can go up and just riff, and it's not always just crowd work. It can be – like the John Wayne thing, not necessarily crowd
work. Absolutely,
it's something
that
just came out of nowhere, and then there's four punchlines. But
that's very unusual. Lots of people can riff off a crowd. You can riff off yourself.
Well, I try to. Or if I'm doing crowd work, and maybe I'm jumping all over the place here on you, because so often people like to say, you know, Jimmy's the best at crowd work, one of the best at crowd work. I don't ever try. Crowd work to me is, what's your name? What do you do? And I try to avoid that. I try to find something that they're saying to then will spark a stupid John Wayne type of riff that goes away from the fact that they were even there. It's almost like improv. It's almost like doing improv. You know, we need a place and a location, and then I hope to find the funny out of there without doing any of that.
Yes.
So, God, as pretentious as it might sound, it's like it's almost like one man improv instead of. I feel better about that than crowd work because I try not to. I don't try to put people down. Some people argue with me that I don't, but. I don't try to – I never make fun of somebody's appearance unless it's a crazy hat, and then I embrace the hat. Like yesterday at PodFest, the guy had on a hat that I saw Dom DeLuise wear once, and so I called that guy wearing a Dom DeLuise hat, and he won it at an auction. And then some stupid thing – then it was a riff.
Yes.
So it starts with that hat, turns into he won it at an auction, turns into an eBay thing, and then, you know, where does it end up?
And it's absolutely not what do you do for a living. He says the job. You slam the job.
Right. Yeah, sure. It's the opposite of that. So again, long-windedly to get to when I know I can do this and I go to a show like I keep saying the Virgil because we're taping this on a Monday and it's a show tonight. I'm not on it. I don't know why I keep plugging it. But and I go up and it's like, okay, here I go. I'm going to go up and do my nonsense of riffing and being funny. And when if it's not a home run, it's like, well, why did I bother? And because if it's just a double, then I feel bad. Like, well, why didn't I deliver it tonight? Why couldn't I? The thing I'm known for, why did I only get 60% of what I was looking for. Does that make any sense at all?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So it's, you're between a rock and a hard place, really, because you want to, like, if you don't feel challenged by the riffing, but also the idea of sitting down and writing, turning in the page of jokes isn't you either.
Right.
Then what is it? How do you get satisfied?
How do I get
from a short set?
From a short set. Yeah. That's exactly it. And that's hurt me in television as well. Like I've done late night shows. I did Leno and I did Craig Kilborn a bunch of times. I did Craig Ferguson, who you very much remind me of. I'm sure you hear that all the time.
Yeah, I hear that a fair bit. Yeah. I tried to invite him on the show on the basis that
we look alike.
You might actually get a kick out of this, but I'm frequently told I look an awful lot like you.
Yes. By the way, when I saw you at PodFest yesterday, because you made eye contact with me because you wanted to introduce yourself,
yeah, yeah.
I was like, and I know Craig enough that the look you gave me would have been like, oh, Craig just recognized me, and now we're going to chit-chat. I was like, holy shit, Craig's here. And so I was like, and then when you go, Jimmy, and then as you got literally about to shake my hand, I was like, that's not Craig Ferguson.
Yeah.
But it's amazing.
Okay.
So I've done the late night shows. I've done the 5 minutes. But I don't have an act that lends itself to that. You know, I've worked on Conan for a number of years, and I'm grateful that I've done panel 7 or 8 times, you know, where I'm able to sit down next to Conan and talk and be funny. Mm. Because if I was asked, hey, we want you to do a 5-minute set, I don't have it.
Would you turn it down?
I would. And I have.
You have.
Oh, I have. I've turned down Jimmy Kimmel a number of times. Not that I'm great. I'm not doing it out of that I'm better than the show.
No.
I'd love to go on Jimmy Kimmel. If Jimmy Kimmel said, will you come on tomorrow and be, hey, we just had a fallout. We need somebody to do, be the second guest on the couch. I'm there.
Absolutely.
But if they say, hey, the stand-up just fell out. No. I don't have a 5-minute set.
And is that kind of self-discipline on your part that you know you can't do the best job you could do in that circumstances? Or is it the result of, like, have you done it and tanked sometime and thought, I'm not going to do that again?
No, well, I did tank on the Tonight Show. I'm back in 2002.
Okay. So I didn't know that, and I feel like it was a leading question. Now.
No, I know you didn't. Okay. But it had nothing to do. It was a solid set. It was a solid 5-minute set. It just didn't click. The entire show was horrible. I mean, Jay's monologue bombed. The first guest was some professor who bombed, and then Marissa Tomei had a bad segment, and then. I was hoping they'd bump me, quite frankly, and then they didn't. And I went up and completely chewed it. I mean, it was the first – it lasted about 4.5 minutes. And right before I was going to go on, they came back to my dressing room, and they said, we're running a little long on time. And I literally – because it was such a bad show up till then. They said, we're running long on time. I go, are you bumping me?
Yeah.
And they go, no, we're not going to bump you. Jay wants to have you on. He wants to end the show on some comedy. But if you're going long – you know, keep an eye out for us. We might tell you that you're going to have to cut your set.
Okay.
So I was like, why don't we just cut the set?
Yes.
So I went up, and I'm not blaming any of that.
Immediately just fought my leg. He's going to make me get me out of this.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So it wasn't – I went out, and my opening line laid flat. The second –
What was the line?
Oh, it was just really establishing my character. I'll tell you a little something about myself. And why not? I'm the guy talking.
Yeah. I can absolutely see that. Dying in a dying room.
Dying.
Do you know what I mean? Because there's, like, right. If they're not switched on, that's a joke. It's not a joke joke. It's not a joke, but it's not AB, is it? Yeah.
It's setting the character.
Yeah.
And they weren't in the groove for it. And so it's like, oh, that got nothing. Now, I'm not expecting a laugh. I'm just kind of expecting recognition.
Yes.
And you know, as a comic, when you don't even get that, like, nod kind of from the audience, yes, like that, okay, we're on, we understand what's happening. I, like, it's like, I even literally, like, felt them going, joke is about, it was about drinking and driving and about how I drove into a ditch. And, you know, but I stopped at the ditch. I'm not doing it comedically now.
Sure, sure.
I stopped at the ditch, looked left and right, then drove into the ditch.
Yeah.
And it was the reason that I was opening the set with it was it never didn't get an applause break. So it's like, let's open with that. I'm going to get an applause break on my very first line, and then we're off to the races.
Yes.
And it, I mean, it did not only didn't get an applause break, it got no laugh. I mean, I'm talking silence.
God.
Silence. And then the rest of the set was a struggle. And then I kind of got him back at the end, kind of. But then, like, I came over to the couch and Jay's like, hey, great job, Jimmy. And I didn't have the balls at the time to go, you know, what set did you watch?
Yeah.
And
yeah,
I wish
wow.
I would have.
Yeah. Okay.
Oh, that's the other thing. I was told, I was given a note before I went on that because I'm such a loose act, you know, this is the Tonight Show. You got to be structured. You know, even though you're known for being loose, stay to your script.
Oh, God. That's the worst thing to say.
And I'm bombing.
Hey, you know that thing you do? Don't do that. Yeah.
And I'm bombing. So when you're bombing, it's like my instincts were to comment on it,
yes,
be in the moment. But I also thought, well, at home, they're going to sweeten this and it won't look like a bomb at home. So just keep going as if, like,
okay,
if you ever see the clip, I'm smiling, I'm acting like it's going
yeah,
well.
Yeah, man. So it's the weirdest feeling, isn't it? Because it's contrary to all of your actual sensual instincts about what's going on, the physicality. It's all about truth, isn't it? You can't lie. But then in TV, you go, yes, sweeten it is a lovely expression.
Didn't. So and I looked crazy. I looked I would hear from through the grapevine that people were like, did he not know he was bombing? Well, of course I knew. I'm not an idiot. But it was atrocious. So
there should be a code amongst comedians that if that happens and you're expecting it to be sweetened, you just tug your ear just during a punchline. Just tug your ear in such a way that all the other professionals will go, at least he knew he was bombing.
He's well aware of it. But since then I had done you know Ferguson and other late night shows where it went great. So I'm not that didn't scare me off. It just was a horrible experience. And I was they even said, hey, you can come, you know, we'll have you back on. That was a weird night. We'll have you back on. I never did it. Never went back on, Jay.
Was that they didn't invite you again? Only they
no, they did.
Didn't
do they, it. They always said, put another set together. We'll have you back on. You know,
and you decided not to?
Did you
take long deciding not to? Or was it like, absolutely not? Or did you go,
it was kind of like, nah.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, it's one of those things where, luckily the internet wasn't around as much as it is today, so it's not floating out there.
Okay.
And it's kind of like
hear the listenership all going, "Ah, rats!" I was looking forward to that.
No, God, I'm grateful. And if some a-hole ever uploads it, it'll infuriate me.
Yeah.
First of all, it's now 13 years old,
sure,
and I probably don't even like the way I delivered any of those jokes. It is a pretty watered down version of me. The jokes are safe. The jokes are they're made for a Leno set. And, but no, it took me, I was like, no, I've done it. I've got the credit.
Talk to me about that. Just a second. Just stay on that idea of watering or like a watered down version or selecting a set for a particular thing. I did my first, TV stand-up set in, not in the UK. In fact, it was in Montreal, the comedy festival earlier this year. My first taping. So I did 5 minutes.
At the gala?
One of the galas. There's like a gala every other night.
Right.
I had a huge kind of, not anxiety, yeah, anxiety about what do I put in? What best represents me? What's the best thing? I'm a loose act. When I'm best, I think it's because I'm being loose and I'm genuinely improvising.
Right.
And then you go, there is the personal temptation, the desire for safety and the potential industry pressure of take my looseness and cage it and varnish it and freeze it and go, hey, this is the guy that's loose and it's not true.
Right.
So those decisions, what kind of decisions were you making about the material you were doing? Were you just kind of going, like that first show, you go, okay, I'm just going to take all of my short applause break stuff. Do you find yourself pacing around running that set?
Yes.
On the night or the day before going, will I fit it into the available time? I mean, what an incredibly weird thing.
It's exactly what you just said. And it was for me, like when I did Kilbourne, Craig Kilbourne, when he had the late show before Craig Ferguson, I told that haircut story. I told a 5-minute haircut story. So I was loose. It's loose and it's fun. And then when I went on Kilborn the second time, I forget, I had a couple of beats. And it was, I still was loose and fun. And but there was something about that Leno set that it was like, it you know, when they over-tweaked it and they overthought it out. And it's like, well, let's move this one here. Let's have you do open here. Let's tighten this joke. And let's lop the tag off this joke. Mm. Like, it was almost like when I worked with the woman, Zoe Freeman, who was at Kilborn. And she just kind of trusted the funny.
Yeah.
And so I felt loose. And then when I had Ferguson, that was really loose. That was, you know, Craig personally invited me to do a show. And he's like, I want you to do my show. And I went out and I remember, and that one's online. And I'm proud of that one.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily how I perform today. It's still a little more structured, but I'm really proud of that one. That way I was loose and fun. Mm-hmm. But yes, exactly what you just said. The idea of taking what usually should take me, like literally if I'm doing 5 minutes, I'm not done saying hello in 5 minutes, yeah, in a long set, you know, because, yeah, I like to go off on tangents.
It's almost like you should go on with 2 minutes worth planned and just spend 5 minutes doing your 2 minutes.
I would love it. I would, but I don't think anybody has the balls to let that risk happen.
Yes.
You know,
And isn't that, why not? Why isn't there, given that this is the artifact which we're showing on the TV to all the millions of people.
Right.
Why isn't there a producer that says, the guest comedian comes in and the producer says, how do you like to work? What can we most easily do? Would you like us to give you a light and tweak the set? Or would you like us to let you be in charge? Or what would you like?
Yeah, I don't know. I guess,
I mean, that would be, you know, it's preposterous, isn't it?
No, well, it's preposterous.
Yeah.
I mean, but I think it probably all started with, you know, I don't want to say Johnny Carson, but even before that, with Ed Sullivan, where they had their tight sets. And it just has trickled down throughout the years of that's how stand-up comedy is presented on late-night shows. And so to that end, and I think I've been pretty good about this, I know I'm not right for late-night television. I know I'm not right to do a set on late-night TV, so I'm not going to do it. Mm. And other guys are great at it. They're great at it. And they should – Jake Johansson, great comic, great late-night guy. Todd Barry, same deal. Todd can go on, and he's got a structured set.
Yeah.
But if you see him in a club, he can be loose. He's got the jokes for it. And that's what goes back to where I wish sometimes I had those jokes.
Yeah.
But I know I'm not a late-night guy. It hasn't hurt my career in any way, shape, or form. It's not what I do. So, you know, we go on with our lives, I guess.
So this is Jimmy Pardo. What an absolute gent. I love this idea of the self-deprecating blowhard. He's such, like that warmth that he has on stage and that he has off stage as well is completely addictive and invigorating. He's one of the people I most look forward to going back and seeing again next time I go out to the States. Do check out the Jimmy Pardo Show, Never Not Funny, it's called. I've just called it the Jimmy Pardo Show. It's not called that. It's called Never Not Funny with Jimmy Pardo. And it is an absolute riot. He's completely nailed that kind of zoo radio feel of having a bunch of people in a radio station talking over each other. And it's really good fun. But don't miss his stand-up. You must download Sprezzatura. It's just an object lesson in what Jimmy does, in this wonderful kind of running self-commentary that you can completely see him. You could just airdrop Jimmy Pardo into any performative situation and he would completely win the audience over. Such is his warmth, his speed, and his constant building up and then knocking down of his own persona. It's completely addictive. More from Jimmy in a second. This is part one. We talked for so long that we've got a whole other episode for you coming out tomorrow or the day after. Couple of little things to tell you. If you are if you're a fan of mine and you're one of these people that goes, Stu, when are you going to do ComCom? When are you going to get asked difficult questions? There is a kind of a version of that available now. I was lucky enough to be a guest on Richard Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast, Rahelastapur. So you can download that from where you would normally find it. If you don't know where he is, then you're living under a rock. But go to the iTunes store. And if you haven't already subscribed to this show, click subscribe. And then use the little explore function, which always confuses me because it's a picture of a compass. But what they mean is search. Go to search and search for Raheling. Search for Herring or R-H-L-S-T-P. And you can hear me creak under the weight of a barrage of confusing and annoying and deliberately annoying questions as Mr. Richard Herring, one of my comedy heroes in my youth, and now simply a target for abuse and the throwing of eggs. We'll talk about some of my... I mean, it's not like a ComCom type interview, but it's a very, very funny interview. I think what I try and do is depth, and what Herring does is... like, he gets the absolute most out of the surface. I'm only saying that to him. I'm only saying that because it's a sort of a concealed... It's damning with faint praise, isn't it? I'm doing it deliberately. I love Richard, and I know he listens to this show. I hope he's listening to this now and enjoying Mr. Jimmy Pardo. And I hope that Richard is cursing himself for not going to America and seeking out new and exciting comics that don't come to the UK. He won't be, of course. He gets brilliant guests on his show. But you can download my episode with him. It's the beginning of, I think, possibly Series 8. But it's just come out, and I'm really, really proud of it. I was really nervous being on his show because he's a big potato in the world of UK podcasting. And I think it was really good fun. So I'll talk about a little bit about street performing, and I'll talk a bit about this crazy children's TV show I did once with the robots, killer robots in the future. That was a lot of fun. And he also asks me deliberately annoying questions about whether or not I have a... What was the one I think we did as part of his kind of online, you know, special content for his subscribers? He asked me some question about whether I would have, whether I'd rather go out with someone who was a giant penis or whether I'd go out with someone whose penis was a tiny man. It's that sort of thing. If that concept appeals to you, you're going to enjoy it enormously. So go and check that out. Some thanks for some brilliant donors. Thank you, those of you who are supporting the show. You can do that in a number of ways. You can buy a T-shirt. You can buy the Warwick Johnson Cadwell designed ComCom Pod T-shirt. That's available at comedianscomedian.com/merch, M-E-R-C-H. And you can select your own size and where you live and all the rest of it. I posted out 10 of those last week. So get on board for next week. There are something like 50 left, or 40 or 50 left, something like that. So it's limited edition. Jump in quick and get yourself one of them. And please, when you do, if you're a person who's bought the T-shirt, then take a picture of yourself, tweet it at ComComPod, or email me info@comedianscomedian.com. I insist that the rest of you is fully clothed. It felt very weird slipping a little note into some of the T-shirts I've been sending out. Saying, hey, send me a picture of you wearing this, particularly if you send it to a woman. It felt, by the end I was writing, feel free to send me a picture. That's what I'm requesting, not some sort of lunging shot. But if you could take a picture of you wearing the T-shirt in the place where you listen to ComCom, that would be great. And then I'll retweet those and send them out. Thank you to people who have made one-off donations, including recently David Adair, Martin Pilgrim, David Shaw, Andy Malt, DFW, Gareth Edwards and Jonathan Mapleston. Thank you for supporting the show with a donation via comedianscomedian.com. There's a big clear button on there, which I designed myself, that you can donate via PayPal or a number of means. And if you would like to set up a recurring payment, you can join the likes of Janine Bayan, Leighton Brown and Laura Sorensen. Thank you very much for the recurring payments. They're great. Jimmy Pardo does a similar system. He has the Players Club, I think, where you get kind of extra content online. If I get round to it in the new year, I will set up something like that. I don't know what I could give you in the way of extra content, though. I feel like all of the interviews I do, I just want to give you all this stuff. Maybe the extra content can be me prancing around semi-clothed in a ComCom Pod T-shirt, something like that. Remember to keep tweeting at me with the hashtag breakglass. Tell me your most stirring and most inspirational bits of the Comedian's Comedian back catalogue. I have started working with composer Steve Dunn, who you may remember from Joel Dommett's podcast. He's a long-time Dommett collaborator. And an excellent composer as well. We had a little play around with some stirring stuff that Josie Long said at the end of her episodes, with him setting it to his own music. It sounds incredible. So I think the break glass in case of emergency episode of this show is going to be a lot of fun. It's not just your favourite moments. It's specifically the bits that you go back to, the bits that you think of when you're in dire straits creatively, when you've just died on your arse, when you've... I don't know, when you've had a tough gig, when you are feeling writer's block, the bits that get you out of a hole. That's what we're after. So feel free to tweet me or email me then with the hashtag breakglass for the breakglass in case of emergency episode. That's all for now. Let's get back to the absolutely electrifying Jimmy Pardo.
Hold up.
What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
I listened to Sprezzatura.
Yes.
Sprezzatura?
Sprezzatura.
Sprezzatura.
Like pizza, like, but Sprezzatura.
Okay. Oh, pizza. Yeah, got it. Sorry.
Yeah, I thought the two Z's make the TS.
I was about, there have been so many cultural references over that I haven't understood over my last few days in LA. My initial thought was, oh, there's a kind of pizza called a Sprezzatura. But I know there isn't, because you explained to me what that sentence means. This is the name of, is it your most recent album?
My most recent CD, yes. Yeah, Sprezzatura. Yeah.
Really, really funny. It's
Thank
a great CD. Tell me again what, because you told me the other day, but the exact words you used were perfect. What is the word mean?
You know, it loosely means rehearsed to look improvised. And
is it a musical notation?
No, I don't think it is. I think it comes from the theater. I've looked this up a gazillion times, so I probably should have a better answer for you. But, okay. What ended up happening? Why are my fingernails dirty? What have I done? I'm not kidding. Now I said it out loud because I don't want you to look at my fingers and go, why does he have filthy fingernails?
Okay.
I'm a nut freak and a clean freak, and so I don't know why that happened. Todd Levin, who's a writer at Conan.
Okay.
It was a brilliant guy. And I was in his office one day, and I was talking about my show, because so often, because of the way that I do my show, being so loose, but I know it's structured. And I said, infuriates me when people interrupt my show, because I know where I'm going. I go, it's loose, but it's organized chaos.
Yeah.
And he said, oh, the Italians have a word for that, sprezzatura.
Okay.
And I went, oh my God, that's the name of I'm naming my CD that.
Yes.
Because it's, I don't think there's a better word that describes what I do. Now, whether the definition is organized chaos or improvised or rehearsed to look improvised, I think both are applicable to what I do on stage. Mm. So that answers that, right?
Yeah.
Long-windedly again.
Am I right in thinking that the track titles on that album are a joke and they're song names?
They are all song names from the band Chicago.
Okay. I should have got that. I got halfway there.
It's the track listing from Chicago 13.
That's very funny.
Yes. Well, you know, Kyle Kinane did it as well. His first CD, they're all tracks from a Cheap Trick album.
Okay.
But I always wanted to tip my hat to my favorite band, which is Chicago.
Okay.
And it was like, well, I'm never going to sing a song. I'm not a musician. I can't cover a tune of theirs. So you know what? When I'm comfortable enough, I couldn't do it on my first two CDs because nobody knows who the hell I am. But now I have a fan base. It's like, you know what? I could finally do what I've wanted to do. And Kinane beat me to it.
Oh, man. By how much?
Maybe a year.
Okay.
But I still did it.
Yeah.
Every now and then, Chicago fans will write me angrily. What? Well, I'm doing a Google search for Street Player, and you show up and like
amazing.
Okay,
I'd done little bits of research. I'd heard the podcast before. I'd seen bits of your stuff on YouTube. I was like Jimmy Pardo album, and I found this weird word Sprezzatura and all of these track titles. I was like, oh, I guess there's a different Jimmy Pardo who's a jazz music. maybe Jimmy Pardo is himself. He's released a jazz album.
Yeah,
so it's wonderfully obscured.
Must have been crazy. What does that mean? Reruns.
Yeah,
you're right. Yeah.
So the content of that album, your style. Let's talk a bit more.
Oh, you know what? Can I speak to that?
Yeah, yeah.
And that kind of speaks to it. It's like of what I do, and maybe I'm stepping on your question. There's really no way to put track titles for what I'm doing.
That's a good point.
Because
yes.
I'm kind of riffing in the moment.
That's cleverer than my question. Let's pretend that was my question.
Okay, I will. I'll go along with it. So the song titles kind of make sense as well for that reason. So like, well, we have to divide it up, especially in this day and age of, you know, Sirius XM and stuff like that and Spotify and people, you know, Pandora and things being played. You can't just have one long track. So it's like, well, if we got to call them something, you can't, what am I going to call one? Sweater? You know what
yeah,
I mean?
Right.
So it's
yeah,
more
yeah.
fun to... for me, it was more fun to give them the song titles.
Yes, yes.
So what was
okay.
your question?
So what I was going to ask was for people who are listening to this who haven't seen you before, I'm sure they can get a sense of the speed, the pace of your delivery. Something else I noticed you... And I suppose it's sort of in line with this idea of it being like crowd work on oneself, you know, kind of like the one man, the improvised play idea. But I've noticed that you enjoy doing a running commentary on... what you're saying, how you're saying it, what other people are saying. Like
yeah.
there's a minimum of two levels going on. So you're improvising and then you're commenting on how well or badly your own improvisation went.
Yeah.
And like I noticed in the podcast yesterday, you said something to Matt and Matt said something about a sweater and you went, that doesn't work. Sweater's too wordy. Do you know what I mean? And like it was absolutely on the nose bit of instant comedy criticism because I was thinking it doesn't quite work, and then you completely said exactly what I was
right.
thinking. So where
wait, are you saying you said it faster than me? Is that what you're getting at? Is this your way of saying you're faster than me?
Well, now we realize the secret agenda of this podcast.
Oh, here we go. This is me. I've been doing your act overseas.
No, what I mean is you said it. Like it was perfect because you spoke the thoughts of the audience.
Yeah,
exactly right. In a way that like we hadn't really realized it, and you know that it's just a great joke. So my question was, how did that develop? Was that something that you always did?
Boy, that's a great question. I don't know. You know, my stock answer kind of for what I do, and this – I don't know if this will 100% answer your question, but I was a
– Let's give me the stock answer, and then we'll pull it apart, and then I'll get to feel clever about myself because I'm like, oh, well, he took apart Jimmy's stock answer. Give me all your – let's do that from now. Give me your stock answers, and then we'll go deeper, and I'll challenge you on them.
But this kind of – speaks to what you said. I was a great open micer, and that's the truth. When I was doing open mics in Chicago, specifically at a place called the Roxy, I was loose and great and funny, and I would do kind of what I'm doing today, where it was having the confidence, and it kind of comes from that, having the confidence to admit, that wasn't the right word. Whereas a lot of comics would go to, you know, if, oh, they didn't laugh, they're wrong.
Yeah.
You know, but if it's the wrong word, you know, I think it's funny to then riff on its wrong word because then you might find three more laughs that you wouldn't have gotten if you just would have laid it if that would have just laid flat and you just moved on.
Yes.
When I was an open micer, I think I did stuff like that because people always loved watching me as an open micer and I took chances and I was funny, and then I started getting paid work and became a quote unquote professional comedian, quit my day job, and then I took it very seriously. And I was an average white guy working very hard to be an average white guy comedian. Like I was, you know, I probably wore the sport coat with the rolled up sleeves and the skinny tie, and I was doing almost an impression of a comedian.
Yes.
Like I forgot everything that got me booked, basically, and thought, well, now I'm getting paid. I better be a comedian.
I better
now.
Rein it in,
yeah. Right?
Yeah,
I better
yeah.
rein it in.
Yeah.
I better again. I better tighten up that looseness and deliver the 15 minutes that I'm being paid to do. So I kind of was not good as a comedian for a lot of years, and then whatever clicked, I remember it was New Year's Eve 92 into 93 where it just kind of clicked. I forget, I don't even know why. I was in Indianapolis, Indiana, and it just was like, I can't just keep doing this. Like I don't remember saying that to myself, but then it clicked where it's like, go back to what people loved about you. And then I kind of took it from there.
Was that as the result of a gig? Do you feel like that decision was made on stage, like when a gig was going south because it wasn't loose enough?
I wonder if it was. You know what? I don't remember exactly. I just, again, I remember the city. I remember the two people I was working with. And I just remember just not even being happy in comedy anymore. You know, I don't remember. I just remember thinking – I got sick of being told you're the funniest guy off stage. I got, you know, it's like, because I would hear that all the time and I would be like, yeah, but I'm being paid. What do you mean I'm the funny? Yes, I'm funny off stage, but I'm good up there too. And nobody was ever saying that.
Yeah.
Nobody was ever going, you know, it was great to be part of it. I would never hear that. I'd show somewhere on the road and people would go, oh, you know, it says Gary Lazor says hello. He says, you're the funniest guy to hang out with off stage. And no, they're not wrong. Yeah. But you want the compliment to be, oh, yeah. Gary Laser loved working with you because he thinks you're, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So all of a sudden, again, I don't know what clicked, but it clicked. And then I went back to being me and taking chances on stage and being loose and eventually finding what I'm doing today. I mean, that's 20 years ago now. This was 92 and 93. That's 22 years ago, as weird as that sounds, that I was like, oh, I can't – I got to stop doing that and start being more me. And it took me years to get to what I'm doing today with the confidence and to take the chances and to go down a path and to – maybe there's a payoff, maybe there's not. And I had some years that I was angry on stage, you know, working out, you know, relationship issues where everybody was stupid and I'm smarter than the audience. And so I had years, basically all of 95, I was angry on stage and the audience was dumb. They're not laughing at me. They're dumb. And I would lash out at them and call them stupid. And
would that still get laughs?
No,
that,
no, God, yeah. No.
Okay.
No. In fact, I speak about this, and this will mean nothing to your listeners overseas. But there was a booker by the name of Mark Colo. He worked for John Yoder's Funny Business, and they booked like 30 clubs in the Midwest here in the States. And I would go to these clubs, and they would tell over and over. They would tell the booker, "We don't want that guy back. That guy, he's not funny. He's angry. We're getting complaints." But they knew I was funny, so they kept – Mark Colo kept booking me, and he would keep sending me back to these clubs. And I'm grateful that he did because I may have been out of the business. I may have been gone because I wasn't being funny. Mm. But now all that said, that year of not being funny is part of what I do today because now instead of just being angry on stage, if I get mad on stage, it's with humor you know, that I may not have found if I didn't spend a year being – truly angry.
That's very interesting.
You know what I mean?
Yes, because that's certainly part of your persona, part of why your persona is so successful is its richness. And it is rich because you're angry with us and you're angry with yourself and you're barking. And then there's parallels with Todd Glass, you mentioned before, in that there's kind of warm anger.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? With him, it's kind of, with him, I would say it's kind of warm anger. With you, anger, it's not.
Anger
isn't quite right, is it? But it's a sort of a very high status and a wink about the fact that obviously you don't deserve that status.
You don't deserve that.
Do you know what I mean?
And none of this is real. I'm not mad at anybody. I'm not mad at that. You know what I mean? It's like we're in it. Like the audience is in on it. We're like that year of 95 and maybe even a little bit of 96. they weren't in on it. They were watching a guy working through issues.
Yeah.
But again, needed to go through it to find this today that I'm doing today.
And do you find that you have certain – do you catch yourself doing certain systems or certain repeated rhythms? Do you ever kind of – given that you're very, very loose, are there kind of grooves that you fall into of how you approach a subject or how you approach an audience? Do you need to kind of keep changing it up or is it all just – it's always different?
No, there's definitely – you know, there's the skeleton there that that I will fall, you know, or no, yes. Hi, I'm Jimmy. Wow. I locked up on that question.
No, it was great. I loved it. keep going. Push through.
I think
What are you struggling with? What are the two conflicting?
I don't know what I'm conflicted. I think I'm conflicted. I don't know why I'm conflicted. ask your question again.
When you're improvising, when you're being loose, are there grooves into which you notice yourself falling?
Yes.
Like there'll be a person there. You pretend that he's threatening, say, I don't know, I'm sort of winging this, but like you pretend that he's kind of threatening and you treat him in a certain way. And then that gets a laugh. And then you let yourself out of that laugh in a certain way. And you kind of, you're aware on some level that, oh, that's how I treat people who I've pretended.
So then are you asking then if I would replicate that a second show?
Not that you would deliberately replicate it, no, but that over the amount, the vast volume of stage time that you've got, whether you notice, whether you ever kind of go, oh, I think I've done that one. Oh, I think I've done that.
Yes, of course. Yes, of course. There's your answer. One word. After all that conflict. I think so. Yeah, I think so. I mean, but I try to make it fresh. You know what I mean? But I think there's some times where it's like, the cogs, the teeth of the gears will give you the same kind of reaction to a guy, you know, to use your example of a guy maybe being threatening and to go into the same kind of rhythms that I would. I would try for it to be interesting and unique to that individual. But you know what? Hey, that worked in the past.
Yeah, so, sure. Sure.
You know, they line up and hear it,
so
spit
what,
it out.
So what was the conflict about? What were you?
That's a great question. What was the conflict about? Maybe just trying to find those words.
Okay.
I'm not sure what the conflict was. I wish it wasn't there. I'll tell you that. I wish we hadn't lived through that. Boy, that's a great question. What was the conflict?
Because it looked to me like you, I'm wildly speculating, but it looked, my instinct was maybe there was something you didn't want to, either you didn't want to reveal or you didn't want to sort of make it sound like, oh yeah, I repeat the same bit sometimes, or there's some sort of reticence on
your
part.
I don't know, maybe, but maybe that's what I was trying to go down when I said the skeleton, because that's always there. There are the, you know, there's the tent poles of my act. But
and are those material tent poles?
Material tent poles.
Okay. Places there, to which you're going to get.
But there's also the, you know, and maybe this is where I was conflicted on answering. Like, I'm not 100% sure that this is the answer you're looking for. And it's not because of the replicating. But, you know, if somebody's wearing a bright shirt, I might, you know, it'll open up to the Wham joke, the band Wham.
Okay.
Which I'm talking. Oh, this is why I was conflicted. Because I do go through phases. Like right now, Wham is getting a lot of action in my show. That's
and
the truth.
And about time, right?
It's about time. 30 years later, it's about time those guys are getting their due. But that's the truth. Like I go through these phases where Wham is just – there's a lot of Wham talk in my act right now.
Because at the moment, you're finding the concept of Wham or the word Wham just funny at the moment.
Well, I'm all of a sudden going through a Wham phase musically where I'm revisiting
them. I was going to suggest, is it like a kind of, like this might just be me, but you know, you get like earworms, you know, yeah. You get a particular song. I've got a couple of default songs that I will find myself humming the march from so-and-so if I, you know, this makes it sound a bit operatic. I didn't mean that. Right. The last minute, I was going to make it sound like the march from the Emperor's March, but that isn't one of them.
That's Star Wars, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. I didn't want to, you know, it's been a very nerdy weekend. I didn't want to do another Star Wars reference. I find I have kind of default tunes that must be going on in the back of my head, and then over time they change. You have phases of them.
Right.
So maybe it's something similar.
It is similar to that. And again, I know this was a really convoluted way to get to what may not even answer your question. But I guess that's what I was conflicted. There are these phases I go through. And so it's that. Like, who knows? I forget a couple of months ago. I can't even pull what it was. But I know that I was on some other jag for a while. And that would always be in my act. And then people, oddly enough, it was The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald, the song by Garden Lightfoot, where I would act like I was an expert on the Edmund Fitzgerald. And it would be no matter, but it was only lines from the song. That was the only, that's the only thing I know about that damn event. But I would, they would somehow be part of, like if somebody would answer a question with the audience, somehow The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald had an answer for me. You know what I mean?
Okay.
And so I went through this phase and then like, it was really in peak form in Peoria, Illinois. And when I went back to Peoria, a guy said to me, I can't wait to see that Edmund Fitzgerald stuff again. I'm like, that's not even near the surface of being able to talk about. Now it's all Wham, baby. You know what I mean? So,
okay.
So I do, yes.
I was talking about your persona and that idea of the warmth and the kind of the status.
Mm-hmm.
What other elements do you think are kind of central? In your mind, who do we, the audience, see when you come out on stage?
Oh, boy, that's a great question. You know, I called myself, what did I say once on my podcast? The something blowhards. And I think it's like I'm a self-deprecating blowhard. Yeah. And I think it's fun to.
That's a great.
Isn't that kind of?
Yes, that's lovely.
Because I'm not afraid to laugh at myself. I'm not afraid to put myself down. At the same time, and I always like to joke, the audience is the enemy, and they're wrong. I can never be wrong.
Yes.
And so they're always being reprimanded.
Yes.
But yet, they know that I know I'm wrong. You know what I mean?
That's so great. Yes, yeah. That's exactly what it is.
But it is a blowhard. I don't mean any of it. You know, it's comedy. I'm not political or anything either on stage, so it's not like when I say I don't mean any of it, it's not like I'm taking a stance and, he doesn't really believe in that.
He's not really into sweaters.
I am into sweaters. I love him. So I think that's the best way to put it. It's like a self-deprecating blowhard.
Let's talk about, you work on Conan.
Yes.
And the work you do on Conan, I believe I have heard you interviewed elsewhere. What I you didn't talk about it explicitly, but you do the warm-up.
I did the warm-up. I've since left that position.
Okay.
I'm now in a development deal with Conan's company to create my own show. But I was his opening act. I always said opening act because warm-up comic to me is always the guy that comes out, kind of acts like – and some guys are very, very, very good at this. They've got to entertain that crowd every commercial break. They've got to entertain them for a half hour before the show starts. They have to stay there. Basically, they're babysitting, holding their hand. They've got to be energetic for several hours, and they're warming up the crowd. Keep it going, guys. Guys are doing great.
I've done a lot of that work, and I'm going to think of it as babysitting from now on. I've done loads. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure not by your standards, but I've done a good bit.
So when I was asked to be the warm – when Conan O'Brien moved from New York to L.A. to take over The Tonight Show and they contacted me, Andy Richter was kind enough to suggest me for the job. Legend has it that he said the guy in L.A. that can riff from 5 minutes to an hour that has the same sensibilities as our show is Jimmy Pardo, that's who you should hire. Mm-hmm. And they were smart enough to do a little research and trust Andy, and they called me in for an interview. And they said, we want you to be the warm-up act. Now, I took the meeting because how do I not take that meeting? But I didn't want it to be a warm-up act. That was not my intention. Desires in Hollywood was not to be the warm-up guy throwing out candy and having people do dance contests. That wasn't my bag.
Yeah. I have not done either of those things.
Well, you're lucky to not.
Never will. Yeah.
Right?
That's the warm-up. You don't want to be the warm-up.
I don't want to be the warm-up. Yeah, yeah. So when they said, I said, well, I really don't. I'm not sure, guys. I appreciate the meeting. And they said, well, no, you don't have to do any of that. You just go out. And at the time when I first started, the warm-up was only doing maybe 7 to 8 minutes. You know, you go out for 7 or 8 minutes and then you're done.
Then you go off and do a gig.
You go off and go home. You stay and watch the show if you want, whatever you want to do. And I was like, wait, what? And they go, oh, yeah, you just go out. Yeah, you got to hit the turn off your phones. Hey, here's your exits. You got to do the legal things that are involved, the safety legal, and then also the show business. Turn off your cell phones. Don't yell out like an asshole, but otherwise, we really just kind of want you to do comedy. And we watch what you've done, and you're the right guy. So I was like, well, how do I not take this gig? Mm-hmm. And I took it, and I wasn't good at it. I was not even good at that for a little while. I had to find my footing on how to – because that audience doesn't know that this warm-up experience is going to be different. They're kind of wondering, why isn't this guy running up and down the aisles? And I tried to do that. I tried to run up and down the aisles. Didn't work. Eventually, I just settled standing right in the middle of the stage as if I was doing a show. And it clicked. And then The Tonight Show ended, and we had a little hiatus. And we came back at TBS, and I was lucky enough that they rehired me. And then it just was – I just, once again, became me. Almost like – it almost mirrors my stand-up career in that when I was at The Tonight Show with Conan, I was trying really hard to be a warm-up act. Mm. And then once we went to TBS, it's just like, you know what? They rehired you. They believe in you. Be you. Be funny. Do what you do. Riff. Be in the moment. And I had a great time for 5 years doing it. And then it was time to leave. They felt it. I felt it. It was. And so when they came to me and they said, hey, we want to transition you out of this warm-up thing and give you a development deal, it was the perfect time. Because I was going to treat it like my buddy Jimmy Dore's got a great joke about college is like a strip club. You don't drop out. You leave when they ask you to. You leave when it closes or something along those lines. I just mucked up his really good joke. But I felt that way about this Conan job. It's like, well, I have a paid gig in Hollywood. It's literally – and then, by the way, as time went on, it went from 7 minutes to 8 minutes to where, like, I was doing close to 22 by the time it was over because they kept expanding my time because I was good at it.
Yeah.
And I was the right guy for the job.
Yeah.
And then when they came – and I was going to stay there until they told me to leave. And then they called me in for this meeting one day and said, what do you think about this? I was like – love it. Yeah. So I still kind of work with them there, but I'm not there every day anymore.
Do you feel there was a stigma attached to it, not just in your own mind, which are, that I'm thinking like not wanting to be the warm-up. Do you feel there was a stigma attached to it in how you were regarded in the comedy industry?
Well, ordinarily I'm going to say yes. And I bent over backwards to over-explain it, like I almost just did here to you. But I remember feeling, but I'm not the warm-up.
Yeah, sure.
Which is why I ended up calling myself the opening act.
Yeah.
Because, it made me feel better about it because I'm not saying I'm a warm-up. And when they go, I hear you're doing warm-up for Conan. Well, I don't really do a warm-up. I'm an opening. I get to go out and then I don't have to stay. Like I did because of the stigma. But then once it was like, you know, to myself, you know, it's like, but it's Conan O'Brien. It's not some bad sitcom on the CW. You know what I mean? This is one of the great late night hosts of all time. You know, be proud that you work here. You don't have to, always, you know, clarify it or, you know, defend what you're doing. You got hired to open for Conan O'Brien. This is great. So eventually I settled into that as well.
And do you stand by that now that you've finished and you don't do it? Do you kind of think, I was basically the warm-up guy?
Of course, I was basically the warm-up guy. I mean, that was my title. That's what it said on my check.
Yeah, really. Okay. You in the original meeting. Oh, you can call it what you want, Jimmy.
Yeah, whatever gets you through this, jerk. Exactly. But I got very lucky that when we came back at TBS, although I did do one remote for the Tonight Show, and my personal appearance agent actually said that this is the one show that he believes that once they see how funny I am, I will branch out. And sure enough, I did a remote for the Tonight Show. It ended up not airing. I forget why. And then when we went to TBS, after the show found its footing, I ended up doing remotes. They gave me my own web series, you know, the Pardo Patrol, where I would interview celebrities backstage, which I did 30 of those. I filled in for Andy Richter when he couldn't show up for a couple of days because he had a different thing to do.
What was Andy Richter's role on the show?
Oh, he's the co-host.
Gotcha. Okay. So we don't get it in the UK.
Oh, you know,
I've seen bits of it online, but only Conan's bits.
So they asked me, they called me up one day and they said, Andy can't be here a couple of days next week, maybe even the whole week. Conan wants you to co-host with him. And like, they're like, do you want to do that? I'm like, yes. I've been, you know, my joke was I've been slowly poisoning Andy every day for this phone call to happen.
Yeah.
And so it's like So that also made me feel better about being this warm-up act. Like, it's because nobody treated me like a warm-up act.
Yes.
Here I am. Hey, Andy's not going to be here. Who do we get? We get Jimmy.
The depressing thing, I think, about warm-up, or what can be, or what the act can feel about warm-up, is that, I mean, there's a famous story about a comic on the UK circuit who was doing warm-up for a panel show with seven comics, and one of them dropped out, and the producers came and said, hey, we've had a dropout. You're a comedian. Do you know someone?
Oh, God.
And that's everyone's – for the benefit of the listener, Jimmy is clutching his head in despair.
I am, because
that's everyone's nightmare,
could
right?
Could you imagine if that happened to me like if all of a sudden that day where Andy wasn't there and I had since found out that they were thinking about, because it was at the same time like the ESPYs were in town, ESPN's sports awards, and then something else was in town. They're like, well, maybe we can get an athlete. You know, maybe, you know, John Hamm is a friend of the show. Maybe John would have some fun co-hosting. Maybe it's a different celebrity every day. Mm-hmm. And Conan, he's like, no, Jimmy Pardo's the right way to go here. And so if they had gone with another comedian, like this is of course hindsight. Would I have sobbed? Would I have gone to my car and punched the steering wheel? Like I don't know what my reaction would have been. Would I have quit? Like, because I know I would have had a reaction. I would have been furious if they came to me, Andy's not going to be here. Do you know anybody? Yeah. Oh my God. Like, or you know anybody? Do you think John would do it? Like, I would have just been crushed. But luckily, that didn't happen.
So that was Jimmy. More from him tomorrow or the next day from comedianscomedian.com. Remember to subscribe at iTunes. And we should be getting hooked up with our own unique iTunes address soon, which will be nice. I don't know if it helps, but it'll certainly sound pretty classy. Thanks to Steve Wilson, who's one of the iTunes heroes, one of the podcast ledges that I met in LA where I recorded this episode. More from Jimmy Pardo in the next episode. Remember to email me info@comedianscomedian.com or tweet @comcompod if you'd like to suggest guests, find out more about the show, give me your feedback, or indeed suggest episodes or your favourite moments of episodes. Give me a time code if you can, or a rough idea of when it happens in the ep. Because that'll make it easier administratively this end. Get in touch with me and suggest your most stirring and inspirational moments, and we'll whack them on the 150th episode, Break Glass in Case of Emergency, to come out mid-November. More from Jimmy soon. Thanks to everyone that donated. I'll speak to you soon.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.